Thanks.
This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. Our topic is Homeland Security, the Department of Homeland Security, prevention of and responding to terrorism and hate crimes, and responding to natural disasters by the Federal Emergency Management Administration, that's FEMA. The Department of Homeland Security, DHS, was created by the Homeland Security Act of 2002. It incorporated the Federal Emergency Management Agency, that's FEMA, and 24 other pre-existing agencies or parts of them, and believe it or not, more than 180,000 employees. I'm very pleased to have as my guests Martin Alperin, attorney, first responder as a law enforcement officer. He's the author of Foundations of Homeland Security Laws and Policy, which is an incredible book. He is practicing law in San Francisco as now an immigration attorney. My other guest who's here in the studio with me is Jeffrey Hayden, good friend of mine, certified specialist in criminal law. He's chair of the California Board of Legal Specialization with his office in Redwood City. And Michael Berg is with us from San Diego. Michael is a certified specialist in criminal law. He's also a board member of the California Board of Legal Specialization. His office is in San Diego. This segment of Your Legal Rights is funded by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, and the National Board of Trial Advocacy. And Martin, let me start with you. Can you define Homeland Security for us?
Well, I can tell you that it means different things to different people. If you're in California, Homeland Security might include something about earthquakes. If you're in the Gulf of Mexico, it may include something about hurricanes. So it means different things to different people.
Well, that is that because of FEMA?
That's because DHS would be responding to different things in different parts of the country.
But you're talking about disasters, natural
disasters. In terms of terrorism, it's the same across the country.
Okay.
New York thinks it has a bigger risk than Indiana, but I disagree with that.
Why? Why do you disagree with that?
I think that terrorists are looking for the biggest bang for the buck. And if everything is hardened in New York City, which is very true, and they have an incredible police department and they keep very vigilant watch on things. They even have their own secret agents that go to Europe and monitor things in Europe, New York City Police Department.
Really?
Yes.
I did not know that.
And Indiana doesn't have all those assets, but there's just as many people. It just spread out a little bit more.
Just to clarify this for all of us, you are not a member of the Department of Homeland Security at this point and have not been a member.
Correct. Never have been.
You are a graduate of the Navy Postgraduate School in Monterey, California.
Correct. I have a master's degree in Homeland Security from the Naval Postgraduate School.
One of the things that I think is important that I'd like everybody to know about, and this is something new that came that I found on the Internet in the last couple of days. Apparently some scammers, and I want everyone to be aware of this, have somehow gotten hold of the Department of Homeland, a hotline of the Department of Homeland Security, and are using that and contacting people who are unaware, trying to get their names, their social security numbers, and other personal information, and scam them. And so I want everybody to be aware of this. Apparently, I know that, Martin, you did some research on this. The Department of Homeland Security is not calling people. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah.
This is being done by some criminal.
Yeah.
Criminals.
Yeah. So people be very careful about this. Michael, let me come to you for a minute. You're down in San Diego. You're dealing a lot with apparently immigrants coming across from Mexico. I think it's worth it. President Trump wants to build a wall down there. What do you think? Should we have a wall down there?
Well, we don't need one down here because we already have one. There is a wall between Mexico and the United States all through San Diego County, and it's been here for quite some time. It's up, and it's been working, and there's nothing that President Trump needs to do to change what's already in San Diego.
Well, in your opinion, what's the point on President Trump saying he wants Mexico to pay for a wall? What would it add that is not there already?
I think he's doing it to get votes. At the time he was running, it was a popular opinion at that time. there's nothing he can do to force it unless he's going to do a complete trade embargo and do it in that regard. But he can't just say build the wall and pay for it. It's an impossibility.
So you feel from the standpoint of our security, we as the people of the United States, our security, California, as the rest of the United States, do you feel that what is down there, the wall that exists now between Mexico and the United States, is adequate for protection of our country?
I do.
Well, that's very interesting. Let me come back to you, Martin. You have written this incredible book. It's really more a textbook than anything. I have no background. I've been a lawyer for a long, long time. I've never dealt with Homeland Security or this kind of law. But you have put together this incredible book, Foundations of Homeland Security Law and Policy, that if someone is really interested in this, they should pick it up. There is a website also, is there not, where the people can get some more information about this?
Yes, it's homelandsecuritylaw.us.
So that's very simple. It's all one word, homelandsecuritylaw.us.
Yes, it has a link to the book. Two links. One is the Amazon link. One is the Wiley Publishers Company link.
I see.
It also has a couple of videos that I think are very important. One is called Up From Zero. It's an hour-long video put out by the Department of Transportation, I believe, about 10 years ago, and there's no copies of it. I have a copy of it, and I have permission to have it on my website.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the demolition of the World Trade Center after it was bombed.
Oh.
And some of the same people that put it up 25 years ago, now in their older years, are taking it, took it down. It's a wonderful story. It's uplifting.
Really?
Even though
That's
it's
right.
a sad thing, it's an uplifting story.
The website is what again now?
HomelandSecurityLaw.us.
Talk about preparedness, Martin, would you? What do you feel we should do? You have a lot of knowledge about this. You have not been a member of the DHS. But you are have a master's from the Navy Postgraduate School in security. What about preparedness?
Well, preparedness is what gives us resilience, and that will really make a big difference in any kind of disaster, natural disaster, and or terrorism. If we have redundant water supplies in the Bay Area, then it doesn't make a difference if there's an earthquake and one of them breaks. We don't have that, so it's a vulnerability at the moment. But if we would be more resilient if we had multiple water supplies here in the Bay Area, resources. If we have no flashlights in our home, we're more vulnerable if the lights go out.
Mm-hmm.
If we have flashlights, we're not so vulnerable. So preparedness leads us to become resilient. And resiliency is vitally important in being able to snap back to a normal way of being after a disaster, whether it be a natural disaster or terrorism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Michael, you're dealing, I guess, with essentially Homeland Security agents in federal court. You handle a lot of immigration cases, I presume. Tell us a little bit about what you do and what your thoughts are about the way DHS agents are dealing with these particular defendants.
I deal with them in court on a regular basis. I do defense, both federal and state, although the Department of Homeland Security is really not involved in the state courts. So in the federal courts, I defend people that are charged with coming across the border illegally, whether it's Mexico or any other country. The Department of Homeland Security agents would arrest these individuals. Border Patrol, Department of Homeland Security. They do drug cases. They actually, believe it or not, they're involved in not just border protection, but, for example, if there's gang members involved in big drug dealing and the gangs are rooted deep in the community, Department of Homeland Security will get involved in that regard. They also are involved in going after child pornographers. They, much like the FBI, they'll set up websites and go after child pornographers. So I deal with the agents pretty much on a daily basis, Chuck.
How do you look upon them as agents who honor civil liberties, or do you have some criticism about them?
Not in particular. I mean, I think that just because they have a badge on their chest or a sign on their back that says Department of Homeland Security, it doesn't give them any more revered status than a San Diego police officer or an FBI agent or an IRS agent, for that matter. Mm-hmm. I think there are good agents as well as bad agents, just like good police officers as well as bad, just like good lawyers and bad lawyers. It's the person, it's not the job or the job title.
Well, let me ask the three of you, what are your opinions about why do people choose to radicalize, become radicals? Jeff, do you have some thoughts on this?
From what I've seen, from what I've read, from what I've seen, the stories of others that have been affected, I don't know that anybody makes that conscious choice. I think I'm going to radicalize. I think that somebody is being influenced. They talk to somebody, it may be a religious leader or somebody that's similarly situated that is persuasive, that convinces them to make small steps in that direction until doing anything else is somehow seen as being making them a heretic or a non-believer. I don't think anybody goes in with their eyes open that they're going to radicalize any more than somebody goes in with the idea that they're going to become a heroin addict. Mm-hmm. You get there by taking very small steps that seem to be okay. It doesn't seem like that one small step is any major change. But then when you look back after making several of these small steps, you realize how far you've come.
Well, Martin, what's
Chuck,
like?
Chuck, if I might.
Yeah, Michael, please.
This is Michael. Before your program started, Martin and I were having an off-the-air discussion, and I think we both somewhat feel that a lot of the radicalization has to do with the economy and despondency, and I think Martin had a different word for it. I forgot the word he used.
But disenfranchised.
Yeah.
There you go. And it basically, when somebody has no future, you know, educational opportunities, financial opportunities, and they don't fit in, as Martin said, they're disenfranchised with the community. They don't fit, and I think they become easy targets for somebody to look at in terms of brainwashing them, or for themselves to, you know, jump on a bandwagon.
You know, there's something as I was preparing for this. I ran across something called Jihadi, J-I-H-A-D-I, cool, and apparently ISIS's pop culture reaching to the millennial generation. Martin, what thoughts do you have on this?
Well, they are reaching to the millennial generation, and we're not doing a very good job of preventing them from doing that.
How can we prevent them?
We are a wonderful country. We do a lot of great things. We need to advertise that we do a lot of great things. Like, we build hospitals and airports and in countries around the globe, and we need to tell them that the narrative they're hearing from ISIS is not correct. The narrative they're hearing from ISIS is that we are evil in all respects, when in actuality, their government is their current leaders are more evil than anything.
Mm-hmm.
So. We're not doing a good job in the sense that our government doesn't popularize itself, doesn't brag about itself. In England, there is radicalization. There is a large population of disenfranchised people, and it's also Minnesota has a large number of young men who go to Syria.
When you say disenfranchised, what does that mean?
To me, it means no hope.
No hope.
No prospects.
I see.
When I was
education, probably.
Yes, it includes having no hope. I mean, what do you do in this world today when you don't have education?
Right.
And you have no money, no education. Where are you going to go? Where are you going to live? What are you going to do to make a living? And somebody blames us, the West, on all their ailments. And I think people will sometimes believe it because there's no other side to this.
Mm-hmm.
There's no
Martin,
one saying this is no one saying that this is not true. Yes, go ahead.
Martin, do you think that the current administration adds to that feeling?
Oh, absolutely. I think the current administration is a disaster in terms of homeland security. The most recent budget proposed by President Trump decimates several organizations that are vital to our homeland security. For example, let me think, the CDC. The CDC is vitally important to homeland security because of bioterrorism.
The CDC is
what? The Center for Disease Control.
Yeah.
In Washington, or I think they're in Maryland. And cutting their budget diminishes the networkedness of our nation.
Mm.
For example, if there is an outbreak of some illness in San Francisco, California, we don't really know if there's our public health people will monitor it, but they don't really know that there's another outbreak in Boston, Massachusetts. So the CDC in Washington or Bethesda or wherever it is will monitor both of those and coordinate between the two of them. And they'll also monitor other countries. So if the same outbreak is happening in other countries, the San Francisco Public Health Department is not going to know, but the CDC will know. And not only will they provide advice, medical advice, they'll monitor this from a public health perspective and try and minimize its spread. So a budget that cuts back on some of our assets, like the CDC, is very bad for Homeland Security.
Let me throw this out to you, Martin. If there was an act of terrorism in the United States today or tomorrow, what could the people who live in that area where there's terrorism, what could they expect regarding a Homeland Security response, both to building resiliency and restoration? What do you feel that DHS can do, if anything?
First, I should say, I think it's not if, but when. I think there will be an act of terrorism in the United States.
Yes, I agree.
It's getting incredibly easier to do it because now we have lone wolves who can drive a truck into people.
Yeah.
And that's been demonstrated, you know, in Europe. What we can expect is, well, I'll use the Bay Area as an example. Because of our location, there aren't a lot of ways to get into, like, San Francisco Bay Area. You have to come from the north over a bridge. You come from the east over a bridge. And then there's the peninsula. So after a major earthquake, the bridges will be closed, and the highways will be damaged. So we're going to have to fend for ourselves for the first 3 days at least.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some organizations called, one is sf72.org, which capitalizes upon the current thinking that you should be prepared for 72 hours
with
water, 1 gallon per person per day, food, and your own meds. So, because no one's going to be able to help you. Right after an earthquake, the first responders, the police and the firemen, are going to check on their families.
Sure, of
and
course.
That'll take a few hours to be sure everything's okay before
they
go to work.
So again, this is sf72.org.
Org, yes.
Which tells what you should be doing to prepare for the 72 hours after some kind of emergency.
That's correct.
Okay.
There are a couple.
You
of
have an emergency preparedness kit, Martin?
I do. It's sitting right next to me. It's my backpack.
what kinds of things do you keep?
I have meds in it for 3 days, toothbrush, toothpaste, a ham radio, a flashlight, and a mask, a breathing mask, a particulate.
You don't have a carton of beer or something like that?
No beer.
No beer.
Do you have your iPhone?
Yeah, my iPhone's always. I'm wearing that all the time.
His iPhone. Michael, let me ask you this.
But the iPhone won't work, by the way.
Oh, because of a disaster like this.
Yeah,
it will not work.
At the very least, it'll be overloaded.
Yeah.
And you won't be able to get an open line. At the worst, and more likely, the towers will be damaged. So you won't have good service.
Michael, let me pose this one to you. I heard on the news today, and I'm not sure which organization it is. I think it's the ACLU, has filed an action against the DHS with respect to immigrants trying to come, I guess, across the border from Mexico into the United States, seeking asylum. Now, you deal a lot with immigration cases. What thoughts do you have on this?
Well, the problem is that if everybody comes, anybody that is not a citizen could easily say they want asylum if there were no protocol in that regard. I mean, what would constitute asylum? So right now they have to have some sort of situation where they're being tortured in their country, or they're it's unsafe in their country, there's a civil war in their country, etc. You can't just come to the border, come across and say, I need asylum, without any type of you know, background in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you feel what's going on right now, you feel is appropriate in terms of the status of the law or the regulations, etc.?
I do. I'm fighting a case right now with regard to that same issue. Mm. But I have to be quite honest with you, Chuck. I have not seen the ACLU lawsuit that was filed today, nor am I familiar with, you know, what it contains. So I'm a little bit at a loss.
Well, I am not either. I'm not, because it was just filed. And by the way, for those of you who are listening to the live program, we are doing this on Wednesday evening, July 12th. In a few minutes, if you listen to the entire hour, I'll invite you to call in with your questions, your comments, etc. We have a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. Martin, you were talking about a case before we went on the air about someone who had immigration problems because I think she was either growing or selling marijuana. And this goes back a number of years ago.
It goes back to 2012, and it was a relative of hers.
Tell us about this briefly, if
okay.
you would.
She pled guilty to a cultivation of marijuana charge back in 2012.
Was that a felony at that time?
It was a felony.
Okay.
And immediately after she served her criminal time on that case, she spent 13 months in jail by the INS, who wanted to deport her. She was only released from INS custody because their jails were too crowded, and they had more evil people to put in jail.
So she was in jail for the crime, but then when she got out of jail, she went into custody with INS.
To be deported, yes. It turns out that she didn't have anything to do with this marijuana cultivation. She was just had an envelope with her name on it in the place where it was found. And we're faced now with her being deported, and it's sort of a knee-jerk reaction by the federal government, including the Department of Homeland Security, that if you commit this crime, you're going to be deported.
Are you representing this woman?
I'm representing this
woman.
You
are?
Now, yes.
Okay. And she is out of custody at this point?
She's out of custody, and we're facing some choices right now on what to do with her. We can reopen her criminal case and go to trial. That's one thing we can do, pursuant to a law that just went into effect this past January. And there's also Proposition 64 that decriminalized marijuana in the state, also made her conviction of a felony now a misdemeanor.
Mm-hmm.
We have to go to court to petition for that to happen. But the real answer is what the feds will do about all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm trying to find out right now.
Are you dealing with the Department of Homeland Security with respect to this at this point?
I'm dealing with a U.S. attorney.
A U.S. attorney.
Yes.
Okay.
Chuck, I don't know if you're aware of this or not. This is Michael speaking. But in a criminal case, in immigration-related criminal case, such as somebody coming over the border illegally, any time a person is granted bail on those cases, they also then have to deal with the immigration courts, because if they bail out on the criminal side, then if there's an immigration hold on them, they'll be taken, and there is almost, you know, 99% of the times, unless they miss it for whatever reason. So they have to go to the immigration courts and get a completely separate and different bond from the criminal court. So if you actually bail out on the criminal court and you go into the immigration court, if they don't grant you a bond, you've then wasted the bond that you posted on the criminal side. You're sitting in immigration court custody and you're not getting credits for the criminal case, so you have to go back to the criminal side and have the bond exonerated, or you're not receiving any credits while you're sitting in custody.
Michael, what you'll find is that is a regional problem, and other parts of the state have different responses to immigration holds. The middle ground between what is traditional and what you're still experiencing in San Diego, the middle ground are states that will report to the INS when they've inquired. They'll ask, INS will ask, or I'm sorry, ICE will ask, Immigration and Customs Enforcement will ask them, is so-and-so in custody, and they will put in a request to be notified of their release date. But that doesn't necessarily get them held in the way it did traditionally when they honored immigration holds. And on the release date, they will notify them, and if the person's out, which is much of the time, the person will get out and leave, and that's the end of it for them. In the past, they had several days to come and get them. It's still that way in parts of the state. Mm-hmm. There's other parts of the state that won't cooperate with Homeland Security whatsoever. What I just described is kind of a middle ground that mm-hmm. some of the counties in the state are now taking.
Are you talking because it's a sanctuary-type city?
Even without a declaration of sanctuary, the sanctuary cities and the sanctuary counties are not going to give any information to the Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Yeah, yeah.
And the middle ground, they'll answer their queries. And, of course, Homeland Security will get the information when they're printed. They'll electronically get notified that this person is there. And when there's a request to let them know the release date, they will pass that on. But they're not necessarily looking for holds. They're not letting Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents work the jail the way they once did. Mm. That's not the far extreme protection. It's not the traditional where everybody gets turned over. It's kind of a middle ground, and that seems to be where they're gravitating.
Very briefly, we're really nearly at the end of the statewide version, which is a half hour that is recorded and sent out to a number of stations in California, which will air the half hour next week. But what do we, what should we, and I'm pointing this one to you, Martin, what should we as individuals in our communities, what should we be doing regarding Homeland Security? I mean, you mentioned the SF72.org so that we're prepared ourselves. What else should we be doing? You've got about 20 seconds. Okay. I'm sorry.
It's all right. I think the most really important thing we can do is to be prepared. And that means having to-go kits and becoming resilient in our own way, so we don't become a burden on the first responders. So assuming you're not injured, you have water, food, and medicine to take care of yourself for several days after an event, whether it be a terrorist attack or an earthquake or a flood or a tornado.
All right, everybody. I'm going to give you an opportunity to call in. I mean, this is an enormous subject that we have been dealing with, Homeland Security, when you talk about over 180,000 employees, 24 different agencies or parts thereof. It's enormous. But please, I welcome you to call in. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. It's my great pleasure to have with me some very significant people. Michael Berg is a certified specialist in criminal law. He's a board member of the California Board of Legal Specialization. His office is in San Diego. Jeff Hayden is a certified specialist in criminal law. He is the current chair of the California Board of Legal Specialization with his law office in Redwood City. And Martin Alperin is an attorney. Experience as a first responder, as a law enforcement officer. He's author of an incredible book, if you're interested in Homeland Security, entitled Foundations of Homeland Security Laws and Policy. It is published by Wiley. It's the second edition. His office is in San Francisco. What I want to do before we take any calls, and I do hope that you will call in, support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The San Francisco Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation in both San Francisco and Marin County. And for a referral to a lawyer or the Bay Area Mediation Services of the San Francisco Bar, the phone number is 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own at 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. With most counties in California have bar association and lawyer referral services. This is a great consumer service that's available to you. If you have a problem in your own county, you can call your local bar association, lawyer referral service. Tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to find someone who's experienced for you, set you up for a half an hour consultation. And with minor exception, you will pay for that half an hour consultation with an attorney who's experienced in the area, between $25 and $35. The money does not go to the attorney. It goes to the lawyer referral service to keep it going for you. Additional funding for your legal rights is made possible by the Family Law Section of the State Bar, the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar, the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. So what I would like to do is see if we can get people who maybe have had some experience either with the Department of Homeland Security or perhaps FEMA, et cetera. The thing that I find really so very interesting to me as I prepared for this, Martin, and is that, of course, you put in your book, is that when DHS got going, it took over, or FEMA, the Federal Emergency Agency became a part of DHS. So how can that happen?
Well, it happened with the stroke of a pen. Congress Congress said
well, that's good enough. Yeah,
Congress said it should be, so it was.
So, in other words, we as members of the public, if we have a natural disaster, we can expect FEMA to be involved.
Yes. In reality, if we have a natural disaster, there'll be lots of people involved.
Oh, yeah.
All disasters are local is one popular saying. So if, for example, we're in San Francisco right now, something happened here, the San Francisco Police, the San Francisco Fire Department, the San Francisco Department of Emergency Management, and the State Department of Emergency Management, and if they need help, they'll get it from either the neighboring state or the federal government. And if there's a terrorist attack, DHS will be here too, in addition to the FBI. So we can expect lots of help, but it may not be here immediately. It may take a couple of days for it to get here. Because, as I said earlier, how are they going to get here? If the roads aren't passable, there's only one airport in San Francisco in the area, that may be, the runways may be damaged, so it may take a while before we can get help.
Jeff, supposedly the DHS, well, not supposedly, it does have this as its goal, is to protect us from both terrorism and hate crimes. What comments do you have about that?
I see
terrorism and hate crimes.
I see them as two distinct things. Terrorism, as I see it, and I've also looked at the chapter written by the gentleman sitting right next to me, who has some very good definitions of terrorism, but it's generally aimed at some activity that's inherently dangerous to human life, which is done to either coerce people, scare the population into doing something, or influence policy, or maybe interfere with the conduct of government services. A hate crime is something different. A hate crime, as defined in California law, for example, is where you've committed some kind of a felony that's motivated by a distaste for somebody's, whether it's their disability or their gender, their nationality, their sexual orientation, their race, their religion, something along these lines. And it enhances the penalty for that which somebody has done. A little different in orientation. I've always questioned the hate crime laws. I have. I don't know that it for me, it fundamentally doesn't make a lot of sense to punish somebody for what's in their head when you should be punishing them for what they did.
For what they've actually done.
Exactly. So the fact that I go out, you know, I may attack somebody because I don't like their nationality, I should suffer the penalties for having attacked the person, which to me is far more significant than the fact that I didn't like their nationality. Now, it's different when you have groups of people working together to go hunt people down because of their nationality or because of their sexual orientation.
Well,
and I think that's where this was aimed.
That's terrorism, is it not?
Not necessarily. I think terrorism, in my mind, would be more if I want to make sure that this community doesn't function. I want to make sure that they don't participate in government. I want to make sure that they don't leave their house, things of that nature. I want to take out their leaders, things of that nature. That would be terrorism. But I think the hate crime is the idea that you're committing a crime that's motivated because of some of these factors. Now,
Chuck, this is Michael. I think a lot of the hate crimes are just stupidity. They're not even hate crimes. They're just people that are They're young. They're unintelligent about what they're doing. They don't even need to classify it as a hate crime. For example, this is a little off your topic, but I'm representing a young high junior high school kid that spray painted swastikas at his school, and they're going to charge it as a hate crime. And I don't
think
it has any idea what the background of that even is. It's just something so stupid. So
how old is this kid?
He's 12. So I think that there's a little bit of a breakdown when you start calling everything that happens toward a religion or a group a hate crime.
Incredible.
I'd like to make clear something, if I
please,
may. This is Martin.
Please.
Terrorism is an act, a criminal act, for a political purpose. A criminal act for a political purpose. Politically motivated violence. There has to be something politically motivated. There are many definitions of terrorism in the United States Code. The State Department has a definition. The CIA has a definition. The FBI has a different definition. But they all are force or some threat of force to intimidate or coerce a population or change the course of government. So when someone goes out and shoots 10 people, it's not terrorism. They may have created terror, but it's not terrorism, according to our definitions. And the definitions help us discuss it. And
Michael, let me come back to you for a moment. How do you deal in representing a young fellow, a child, 12 years of age, who's now charged with a hate crime? Is that in state court or federal court?
No, that's in state court. And
how do you deal with something like that?
Well, you just show you have to get a little bit of background on the kid, and you can get some psychological reports done. You don't have to always go that far, though. I think when one just shows the prosecutor the act itself, and I think if you educate a kid, get him some required education classes about, for example, the Holocaust and whatnot, I think it does its job. You don't have to throw this label on a kid that what he's done is necessarily a hate crime when he doesn't even have the complete mentality or the understanding of the act itself.
Is he suspended from school at this point?
He's suspended and kicked out. He has to go to register at a new school.
Oh, my. Wow. That's tough. Well, I thank you for bringing that up. For those of you who may be interested in getting California Board of Legal Specialization pamphlets or trying to find a legal specialist, there are 11 specialties of the California Board of Legal Specialization. You can go to the Internet if you'd like to jot this down. The pamphlets are free in all 11 areas of the law. www.calbar.ca.gov, and then go to the upper left corner of your screen to Legal Specialist. Click that on and find your county. You'll find the pamphlets that are available. You'll also, in your county, be able to find those attorneys who have specialties in any one of the 11 specialty areas. So that's, again, www.calbar.ca.gov, and go to Legal Specialist. And by the way, for all of you, and whether you listen to the half hour or the entire hour, if you're interested in hearing the program again, it's available as a free podcast at www.kalw.org/subscribe, SUBSCRIBE. You are all out there very quiet tonight. What's going on? I expected you to come in with your questions, your comments. Perhaps you want to argue with any one of my guests, but here's the toll-free number. Don't be bashful, and please don't wait for another few minutes because we'll be finished. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255, and for any of you in the Bay Area, if you're having a neighbor problem and you are in the San Francisco Bay Area, the San Mateo County Law Library is having a presentation on neighbor law, including such things as boundary disputes, overgrown trees and shrubs, and noise. This is just a few of the issues neighbors deal with regularly. Attorney Greg Rubens will discuss legal and non-legal means to resolve disputes and tips for harmonious living in your neighborhood. So if you're having a problem with your neighbor or or you are the problem, maybe you should go to this. You're invited to attend this free lecture at the Law Library in Redwood City. It's at 710 Hamilton Street in Redwood City. Now, that's tomorrow, Thursday, July 13th at noon, from noon to 1. And if you would like more information about this, the Law Library's phone number is 650-363-4913, 650-363-4913. And certainly, if you want to go, you can bring your bag lunch and have lunch while you're listening to the presentation by the attorney Greg Rubens. All right. Again, the toll-free number here is 866-798-8255. Michael, since you are dealing with a number of your clients who have immigration issues, et cetera, both perhaps who have been arrested for coming into the United States illegally, what comments do you have for us on this?
With regard to what, Chuck?
People who are coming in, I presume you have a certain clientele of people who have been arrested coming in from Mexico to the United States, and you're representing them, or am I wrong?
No. Every day I had two of them today.
Well, tell me, how do you deal with something like this?
Well, I try to get them as little time in custody and back to their home as fast as possible.
So they're going back home. There's no way they can stay here, of course.
It's an impossibility. Yeah, it's really sad. There's a lot of truly, truly heartbreaking cases out there.
I mean, when you say heartbreaking, what are you talking about? Give us a couple of examples.
As an example, I've got a young man that was born in Mexico, came over here when he was just an infant, like, you know, less than a year old, lived in his entire life here. He's married, has kids, but he never got his citizenship.
Oh my.
When he was a young kid, he was a member of a gang, had a violent felony, went to prison, came out, changed his life, working, doing great. Unfortunately, got stopped one day, questioned as to his citizenship, picked up, and deported. He came back across, picked up again, and he has no legal right to be here. He's made a claim for U.S. citizenship, but he never had made it in the past, and so he's got zero ties to Mexico. He doesn't know a single person in Mexico. His family's here, his job's here, everything is here. His whole life is here. He went to high school here, speaks English fluently, yet he cannot stay here. And it's basically killing him because last time he went across, he was there less than a week and attempted to come back because, as I said, he doesn't have any type of a life there. And he's picked up and he's now in custody again. And you know, a situation like that to me is when somebody's turned their life around, they're a productive citizen, they're paying taxes, and you know, you would think that there should be some exceptions made, but they're not, and this administration is making it tougher, not easier.
Yeah. How old is this fella?
35. Now he's looking at having to spend 2 to 3 years in custody.
That's terrible. He has children who were born here?
Yes.
Your focus is on immigration law.
Right, and I've seen equally heartbreaking circumstances.
I mean, this seems so incredibly unfair, it's a violation of our U.S. Constitution.
Well, every day, Chuck, there's cases like that. These are not far and few in between. I'm sure Martin will tell you, doing immigration law, this is becoming the norm, not the exception.
Boy, I'll tell you, that's sad. Martin, what thoughts did you have on Homeland Security?
Well, I would like to say that, elaborate on what I said earlier, that there is no agreement as to what Homeland Security is. This is my favorite topic, is that some people take a very narrow view of Homeland Security, and then it's only about terrorism.
But it's not.
I think it's not. I think that even the arts has to do with Homeland Security, because the arts, music and dance and theater, have been sometimes the only contact between different nations. For example, Cuba, the only contact between Cuba and the United States for 50 years was music.
Oh, yeah.
And the musicians went between Cuba and the United States and they played together. There was no other relationship. And I'm told, I read that in Washington, D.C., it's oftentimes it's food. Somebody from a different country comes to Washington, D.C., and they feed people. They have a dinner party. And sometimes that's the only contact with another culture. And so, in my opinion, bridging gaps is a homeland security matter.
Yeah.
And is people less likely to kill each other if they know them better.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. We have someone who's called Jerry. Thank you for picking up your phone and calling us. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Well, you're more than welcome, and thanks for having me. I have a comment about the comments earlier on hate crime enhancements. I've heard that argument before, but something set me off, and I guess it's this notion of, you know, how can we figure out what's in someone's head and make that into a crime? And that would seem to indicate that intent is now not part of the law, and that seems bizarre given how much intent is a part of all sorts of crimes. What a suspect is going to be charged with or prosecuted for. But particularly on hate crimes, first of all, I'm with you on, a 12-year-old, it's ridiculous.
Outrageous, frankly.
I'd like to know where the 12-year-old first found a swastika.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some parenting issue involved here, or maybe there's not, but that's just ridiculous. And yes, it's outrageous. But let me give you another example. Let's say we're talking about young adults, people over 18. And, let's say I have a nice white garage door, and they walk by and in bright red spray paint put "Go Niners" on the door. Well, you know, I'm annoyed and I'm a little upset. And if they're caught, I expect them to either pay to have they don't need to go to jail, but they do need to pay to have the garage door repainted or do it themselves. Now, if on the other hand they come by and put "Die Dirty Jew" and put swastikas all over my garage door, well, and as it so happens, I'm Jewish and have ancestors who died in the ovens, then it's a whole different thing, and the feelings that engenders, and frankly the feelings of terror that might engender. Makes it a whole different crime in my mind than just spray painting a garage door. And I'd like to get your reaction to that.
Okay, Jerry, thank you very much.
Sure.
That's very, very well done. Jeff is going to respond.
Jerry, I agree with you in part, and I think you and I could probably sit down and find some common ground. My problem with the hate crime laws in California law as they currently sit are that they're so broad as to throw the baby out with the bathwater. If somebody had called you a name at some point in time and then splashed red paint on your door, you would probably be annoyed, but the fact that he called you a name is probably not sufficient to really elevate the charge, and yet the enhancement for a hate crime charge can be as high as the charge itself for vandalizing your garage door. I do understand what you were saying, and I acknowledge that the example you gave with the swastika is probably a more appropriate use of the hate crime law. Perhaps my criticism of it is the breadth of the law, because it reaches so far beyond examples like that. I think when people literally go out looking for someone to attack, and it's not always the dominant group going after others, it's sometimes the reaction is just the opposite. Point being, when you've got somebody going out and hunting for victims because of gender or because of national origin, I think it's a very different picture, particularly when they're hunting in groups, than for someone to do a garden variety crime and call them a name, which is often what's being prosecuted now under hate crimes laws. I just think it's too broad.
I think, are you still there, Jerry? I guess Jerry's gone. Okay, we have another call. Let me give you, we have a few minutes left, and I would very much like to hear your comments, your questions, etc. Our toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. Martin, what else would you like to bring up?
Well, I have some other websites for people to become prepared.
Please, if you would.
One is ready.gov, ReadyGov.
ReadyGov. What's that stand for?
That's a federal government preparedness website.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay.
FEMA.gov, FEMA.gov has one also.
Yeah.
TheRedCross.org is great. If you live in Oakland, it gets more complicated. It's www.oaklandnet.com.
Oakland.
Net. N-E-T.
Boy, that one is complicated.
Now, there's something in San Francisco called NERT training. It stands for Neighborhood Emergency Response Teams. Now, this started after the 89 earthquakes in San Francisco, and I believe the number of trainees is 25,000. They've trained 25, the fire department runs the program, and they've trained 25,000 individuals in how to put out a fire, how to use pry bars and cribbing to get someone out of a, if they're squashed under some debris. And the federal government has a similar one called CERT training, C-E-R-T. That stands for Community Emergency Response. CERT training, C-E-R-T. Community Emergency Response Team.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a similar program run by the feds, which teaches some skills for neighborhood people to help each other in times of a disaster.
Wow, that's
and
very
one last thing,
please.
About your go kit or your survival kit. I've recently switched over from canned food and canned soups with an expiration date to hiking food, which is freeze-dried and lasts about 25 years before you have to replace it.
Really?
Yes. And you just put boiling water into it, and it's delicious.
Wow.
So if you're making a kit for survival for the 3 days before anyone can help you, go with hiking food.
Maybe I should do a program just on survival kits or survival foods. I'm not just being facetious, but, I mean, maybe I should. We have another caller here, Maribyrn. Did I pronounce that correct, Maribyrn?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. So my question is, I have a friend who happens to be an international student, and he was involved in an accident. There was none on the car involved, but he was driving drunk, and he had his friend. It was a golf car, and it flipped, and his friend was injured, and he was taken to the hospital. And my friend was charged with the felony charges.
I'm sorry. Your friend was charged with what?
He was charged. He was charged not for drunk driving, but he was charged. I'm not an expert on the charges, but he was charged like a. He hurt someone while driving drunk.
Yeah.
So, we bailed him out, and he's out of jail for 1 year, and we were not able to hire a good lawyer, but the free lawyer cannot say anything for sure. So my question was, what could we expect to happen for my friend who happens to be a national student and who was involved in this accident? And,
Let me ask you this, Maribyrn. Your friend who was involved in this accident, what county was that?
What county?
Yeah.
I mean, it happened here in San Francisco.
Yeah, okay, all right. So was your friend appointed a public defender?
Yes.
I see. Okay. Well, let me see. I mean, and your friend still has this public defender representing your friend?
Yes, we have him, and he cannot say for sure when the child gonna be, and what to expect. Nobody can say anything for sure. We just bail him out, and he goes to weekly probation officer. He checks in, checks out. That's what he does for 1 year, and nothing can say for sure when he's gonna be sent back home, or he's gonna he gonna be put in jail or stuff.
Well,
so
let me get some comments for you. I mean, at this point, we don't have enough information about this to be more specific, but let me just get some basic comments from you. Jeff, do you have some comments for Maribyrn regarding his friend?
Sure. I can give you an idea. What's probably going on right now is that the lawyers on both sides are doing more investigation and gathering information. It's quite likely that the public defender or court-appointed attorney has involved accident reconstruction specialists of some kind, maybe looking to the toxicologist to see if they have evidence that your friend had been drinking. And there's nothing illegal about being in an accident where someone's hurt unless there's something more. You do something deliberately, mm-hmm. You were drinking and driving, you leave the scene of the accident, or the person is killed. for a routine accident where somebody is hurt even badly, it's not necessarily criminal. So what they're looking to do is to see first, was your friend drinking? What evidence do they have that he was impaired to where he couldn't exercise the normal prudence and caution in operating the vehicle? They're also looking to see if the accident was your friend's fault, because if your friend didn't cause the accident, if it wasn't an act of negligence on your friend's fault, then you have a misdemeanor drunk driving. And that would not have a very significant effect either on the person's penal record or the, I don't believe it would have a significant effect, a first-time DUI, on their remaining in the country.
So that's something. Let me take one. Marilyn, thank you very much for calling. So be patient. Maybe something will open up that will give you further explanation. I appreciate your calling. Our final call is from Forrest. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you for taking my call, sir.
Sure.
It's really sad. My question is, with all of these sad stories that and all of the dangers that they face crossing the border and the many millions that have gotten here, maybe tens of millions, a wall isn't going to be built. Wouldn't it behoove President Trump or our State Department to reach out to the Mexicans of whatever government level and convince them to try and convince anyone trying to cross or prevent them, to educate them of the dangers of pitfalls and what they may face? Wouldn't that help to accomplish something?
That makes sense. Let me get some comments. What thoughts, Martin, do you have?
I'd like to see the money spent on making their life better in their home country.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's no desire to come here to such a degree.
Yeah.
Can I answer that?
Please, Michael,
also?
Please, yes.
I didn't catch the caller's name.
Forrest.
Forrest. I just had a case today where a gentleman is from Oaxaca, Mexico, and he got caught coming into the United States illegally. And he has five children aging in range from 14 years old to 2 years old in Oaxaca, which is in basically southern central Mexico. And he came here, he doesn't speak any English whatsoever, but he came here because he's a field worker and has zero work opportunities where he lives. I mean, there's just nothing. We're talking about people that our average income is probably around $20 to $40 a month, and they are in extreme poverty. And I don't think
I'm sorry, Michael, we have run out of time. I lost track of this.
Okay.
Noise, but I
just wanted to very quickly say education wouldn't matter because they just come, the opportunities are too great here.
Yeah, thank you very much. I want to thank you very much for joining us on the program, gentlemen. I kind of lost track of time here. Martin Alperin, thank you. Jeff Hayden and Michael Berg, thank you very much for joining us. Great pleasure to have you on the program. Next time on Your Legal Rights, we're actually going to be talking about estate planning, focusing on prevention of and how to protect elders from elder financial abuse. My guest will be specialist in estate planning, trust, and probate law, certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization, Linda Kramer, Deborah Radin, and John Martin. I thank you very much for listening to us, everybody. And I hope you join us next time on your public radio station. And this program has been funded by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar and by the National Board of Trial Advocacy, which also funds the public radio satellite transmission of the program. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. I'm Chuck Finney. Thank you.